in association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Jimmy Palmiotti is back. The bad news, Jonah Hex had a very tough week at the box office. The good news, the original graphic novel that Jimmy wrote with Justin Gray, drawn by Tony DeZuniga, No Way Back, is on the New York Times bestseller list for graphic novels. That coupled with the fact that the Jonah Hex monthly comic book continues to churn out great stories from an international group of artists. We talk about that with Jimmy in detail. We talk about Jonah Hex, the movie, the original graphic novel, and the monthly comic in detail. We'll also be talking about Jimmy and Justin's original graphic novel, Random Acts of Violence, a very funny combination of comic book story and horror film. Details to follow. You'll hear about Jimmy translating the Torpedo Crime comics for IDW, featuring great art from guys like Alex Toth and Jordi Bernay. His upcoming projects like the World War II espionage adventure Time Bomb, drawn by Paul Galassi, the new Freedom Fighters for DC, and we celebrate the incredible work of Amanda Connor with Jimmy and Justin on Power Girl and the Supergirl strip for Wednesday's comics. Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they have a ton of Jimmy Palmiotti's work. All there waiting for you at great discounted prices, up to 35% off the cover price. And don't forget that if you get orders of $50 or more, you receive free shipping. How about Uncle Sam and the Freedom Fighters? Jimmy and Justin are returning to the group in September. You can go back and check out the original 8-issue miniseries in this one trade, spinning out of Infinite Crisis, with art from Daniel Acuna. The standard retail price is $14.99, but at InStockTrades.com, it's just $7.94. There's Jonah Hex Origins, collecting Jonah Hex issues 13 through 18, and featuring great art by Jordi Bernay, Phil Noto, and Val Semmicks. The standard retail price is $12.99 at InStockTrades.com, $8.18. Don't forget about their monthly service through Discount Comic Book Service at DCBService.com for all of your comic monthly needs. Check out all the deals at their websites, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com. Just hours ago, saw Jonah Hex.
Okay.
And, you know, it's, I guess I'll say missed opportunity. And it kind of reminded me in terms of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Van Helsing, where I think that they just tried too hard, and I wish they would have just stuck to the basics.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, anything that has diverse hands on it usually loses its way somewhere. You know, I mean, I thought the casting was terrific.
I completely agree.
I mean, all the actors, secondary, Fassbinder, all of them. I mean, actually, Fassbinder actually stole the movie, I think, in a way. But great casting. You know, they kind of did their own thing. You know, personally, if it was me, I would have just done an origin story of when he was a kid with his dad and all that, and then I just would have done issue 50.
Yeah.
And that would have been the film to me. But, you know, it's not... We do the comic, they do the film, so they supposedly know what works in film, and we supposedly know what works in comics. So
understood. And one other thing is, you know, I read that interview, the text interview that's in Jonah Hex 56, and that's the thing. I can appreciate where the director was coming from and the whole idea of confronting technology in the 1800s, and
yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I really think a lot of the themes that I think he wanted to address in the film would have been interesting if he just would have stuck with realism, but I can also appreciate feeling like we're in an environment where, you know, especially when it comes to summer release of superhero films, there's that blockbuster mentality that everything needs to be bigger and more spectacular.
I think the biggest mistake people had coming into this was thinking it was a superhero film.
Yes.
I think what Jimmy and the guys were doing were they were trying to create a new genre. So it wasn't a Western. He called it a Southern, you know. but it was like, you know, it was sort of like a steampunk heavy metal version of Hex. And, you know, some of it worked, some of it didn't. I mean, some of it I was laughing out loud. There was true Hex moments in the film where
agreed.
Talking to his horse and the dog and you know, there was some fun stuff in it, but, you know, we all know Hex doesn't need a Gatling gun because he's great with his own guns. you know, there was stuff in it that was visual. You know, I respected what Jimmy was trying to do. He was trying to take it in a different direction, and they, everything from, the, you know, Neville and Taylor, they did the screenplay. It was not exactly their screenplay, you know, because it got changed along the way.
Sure. And,
I think what we saw was an amalgam of a lot of people's idea of what Jonah Hex was, because some of it was based on the the run, the Vertigo run, and then, you know, a couple of things from our run and from the original run. So it was like this big amalgam type thing that in the end, I don't think it ever was going to have a large audience. That was my whole thing, was that, Jonah Hex movie, it's going to, you're either going to make it a straight Western or you're going to go, I guess, nuts. And they went nuts. Again, not the way I would have done it, but, you know, they chose the direction they wanted to go. And that said, I got to say, it's not as bad as everyone's making out to be. Meaning, I went in, I looked at it as my summer movie meter. Like, I'm not expecting a lot. I'm expecting air conditioning and and not to be bored. And I wasn't bored. I just feel that they should have, I know Jimmy wanted a hard R rating, movie.
Okay.
Jimmy Haywood.
Yes.
He shot an R-rated movie. And I think it got cut down to a PG, I guess, for a wider audience, which I guess looking back now, they probably should have just stuck with the R. Because there was stuff in it that was pretty, when we were there on set, we were there for a day. And we saw them shoot some stuff. And it was pretty damn violent. And then there was this Megan Fox sex scene that was pretty, I won't say, nudity, full-on nudity, but let's just say little was left for the imagination.
Okay.
And when we saw the movie, it wasn't in there,
Well, now that makes, go ahead, I'm sorry, Jim.
So we kind of like, I'm hoping that it gets a second life on DVD, and maybe they allow Jimmy to go in and recut it to the R rating, and if that's possible, then I guess, they can make it whatever it is. I just think, it's hard. A lot of good people worked on it, and it's really funny how people take a lot of pleasure in watching something fail. It's something I really it kind of is despicable to me sometimes.
Sure.
Like and so I'm not one of those people. I don't really take pleasure in other people's kind of misery. I just don't do it. But everyone wanted Megan Fox to fail. Everyone wanted all these weird things.
Sure.
And at the end of the day, a movie's a movie. It comes out. It comes and it goes. And then next week there's another one. And I looked at it as like it was a great thing for us. You're going to hear thunder, by the way.
Oh, that's okay.
In the middle of a giant storm.
Cinema Verite, that's all right.
For us, it gave us the opportunity to, one, get the comic, the name, out there. People now know what Jonah Hex is, no matter what they think of it. And we got to get the original graphic novel out with Tony DeZunga, and that alone was pretty damn cool because, we would have never had that opportunity if this film didn't come along. And in the end, I think we made a lot of people aware of the book and hopefully turned some new people on to the character. No matter what the movie did, there was still a lot of people that really enjoyed it. I got a lot of emails and I got a lot of, Twitter. I have on Twitter, I'm Jay Palmiotti, so people definitely tell me how they feel, which, some of them weren't kind, but I was like, hey, man, I didn't make the movie.
Understood.
I should read the comic. If you hate the comic, let me know.
Sure. Well, and that's, as you say, it is providing awareness, and the good news is if they turn to the product that's out there in books, like No Way Back, and like the stack of trades before that, the wonderful showcase of John Albina, and is it DeZunga? I want to say Tony's last
Tony
name.
Yeah, Tony DeZunga. I call it DeZunga. I don't know. Tony's too polite to correct me if I'm wrong. He's just awesome. Like I said, I feel bad. I wish the movie did better. I wish it made people, I wish it at least had a good opening weekend, I always worry about this kind of stuff, that the B characters, what they consider B characters in comics.
Yes.
The genre stuff, like the losers.
Yes.
And like Hex. And I always worry about those things because those are the books I kind of read, as an adult.
I agree.
I kind of get into the genre stuff. And, it's easier to make a Batman and a Superman in a lot of ways because it has a built-in audience. And the new concepts, again, like Losers, or even, what was the one with Keanu Reeves?
Constantine.
Yeah, Constantine, you're starting out of the gate with something completely new. And unfortunately, people would rather see something they've seen before than pay for something new. And we've seen it happen this summer with A-Team. Toy Story 3, this one 2, that one, you know.
Sure.
People just want the same thing over and over. And when it's something new, they tend to turn their back to it. And that always frightens me because I'm all about new concepts and new ideas.
You have a ton of them, and I want to talk about some of the ones that are currently out and also ones that are coming up in the future. But staying on this current era of comic book movies, I agree with you, and I think this year in particular, there are a lot of B and C properties that are, you know, getting shots at being comic book films.
Yeah.
And I agree. I think it is a tougher sell. You know, you've got your Hellboys and things that aren't, you know, household names that obviously did well in the theaters.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, and these are films that... Look, I mean, Hellboy could have came out in a different week and a different direction. Who knows? You
sure.
You never know. And you know, for me, I honestly, if Hex came out in February, who knows?
You're absolutely right. And, you know, it's I remember a February release of the Daredevil film.
Yes.
And what you're saying about the fact that they shot so many scenes that weren't used, I wonder if that DVD is going to make it a better film if it does come out unrated and uncut. Because I'll tell you, the Daredevil director's cut is far and away better than what we got on screen in the theaters.
Yeah, and you know, it's not so much... you know, movies aren't a single person's vision. They're a whole studio's vision. And, you know, with Hex, they went out and tested it. They had these tests, and people filled out these things. And, you know, I'm guessing they cut it based on the tests. And my thing is, thank God we don't have that with comics. I kind of go with my gut reaction, like, this is good and this isn't good, you know? But they have millions and billions of dollars invested in stuff, and they try it out. But I think they test the water too much. I think sometimes you got to run with something you believe in. And like I said, I think if people have it, if you haven't seen the Hex movie, I refuse to tell you not to see it. I think you go see it and make up your own mind. I honestly, you know, it's like I've been to the movies a couple of times this past couple of weeks. Like I went to see Splice.
How
and
is it?
Splice, people were telling me was amazing, and I saw it, and I was like, yeah, it was okay.
Okay.
You know, I had higher expectations.
Well, right? you're a horror film fan, and I know you're a genre fan, so...
Yes.
I value your opinion, so that's why I am curious.
I enjoyed it, but I thought it would be better. Now,
okay.
You know, so... Because my expectations were high. People were telling me Alice in Wonderland was brilliant. I went to see it and wanted to put a gun in my mouth. I was just so bored. I literally thought it was a bunch of strung-together scenes, and I just hated it. And, so I say, you know, with Hex, it's like, yeah, forget the reviews. If you like this kind of movie, I say go check it out because I think you form your own opinion. I think sometimes low expectations are okay to have when you go in.
I understood. I felt that way last weekend or 2 weekends ago seeing direct-to-video Undisputed 3. And and I like action films. And that's the thing. So I would say if you're going in, much like the Punisher film with Thomas Jane, I would say if you're going in looking for Garth Ennis's Frank Castle, you're not going to find it. If you're going in for a straight-up action film, you might be entertained by it. And I would say the same with Jonah Hex.
I thought, you know, and again, you know, this is us talking. I mean, it's just I thought Tom Jane was great in the Punisher film. I just thought the villain wasn't that good, you know. And you saw the little sparks of where they took Garth's stuff. But honestly, what should they have done? They should have just hired Garth to write the screenplay. Let's be honest. Garth writes screenplays. It would have been crazy, balls to the wall, and even if it failed, people would still remember it as the most insane Punisher movie, you know. And but you know we're in the business of consuming, and it's tough to be on the other side of it. You know, they have to look at this property and say, how do we sell it, you know? And I guess with Hex, they didn't know how to sell it because there was nothing done before like it. It wasn't a straight Western. It wasn't, you know, it was Dragon Balls meets, you know, Jonah Hex meets a steampunk action movie, you know?
Well, and again, that's why I use the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Van Helsing examples.
Yeah.
Because it's trying to make something more of, you know, what was already a decent concept, but I think they were just trying too hard.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, I hated Van Helsing. I didn't like it. It just wasn't for me.
But, you know, I have friends, Jimmy, who are open to this kind of stuff. They're not regular comic book readers.
Right.
They loved it. They loved League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of guy who I would say, go see Jonah Hex and judge for yourself. And
yeah,
I'm betting they'll come out of it and they'll like it.
As a rule, I always say go see something no matter what. I don't care what anybody says about a movie. If it looks interesting to me, I get off my ass and see it. I do not go by the reviews. I do not even go by what people tell me because people have different expectations. And I like different things than most people. I got to say, I'm not the guy to go see Sex in the City too. You know, I'm just not that guy. Now, if you put, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead. You can say it, Jimmy.
No,
we're on world rated.
You know, if you had Hex shooting those girls, that would be kind of fun.
Okay, there you go. Well,
all right.
All right. Now let's go back to the product that's out there, because consistently month after month, you and Justin write great Jonah Hex stories, and you guys, as I said in our video interview back in May, you get these incredible artists to come in, and it's the only place that you will see them doing American comic book work. Jordy Bernay. I don't know where else you've seen recently David Michael Beck, but in these books, you know, the C.P. Smith story and Phil Winslet of the last issue as well.
Yeah.
I mean, great stuff, man.
Yeah, well, we try, you know what it is, we like variety, obviously, and a lot of times these creators are between gigs or they're looking for something a little different to do. In the case of Phil Winslet, you know, we worked on him when we did the Monolith together, and I've been trying to work with him again in any shape or form, and we had this short story, and I think we wrote that one around for Phil, because it had that kind of feel to it. But, yeah, we tend to kind of jump to different artists. You know, our regular guy, in a way, is Jordy.
Right.
We constantly have Jordy working on a Jonah Hex story. Now, he does, like, six a year, so it doesn't mean it's every other issue. We kind of space them out. But we constantly have Jordy. He's our regular guy, and he's also our superstar. And then, you know, the other people, either they come to us or we terrorize them, like guys like Darwin and J.H. Williams and... the list goes on and on. We kind of say, you know, we'll write one special for you if you do it, and usually that's an interest of interest to them instead of the usual. Here's a story, draw this. You know, we even go so far as we ask them what kind of things they would like to draw in the story, and then we kind of craft the story around what they like.
And you even reach back and get guys like Tony even before No Way Back. You know, he's been in the book. We talked about how Dick Giordano was able to do a Hex story before he passed.
Yeah, well, Dick, you know, Dick sent an email to me and said, you know, I always wanted to do a Jonah Hex story, blah, 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 and, you know, I'd really like the chance at that. And you know, we looked at the email, we're like, oh, my God, you know, because we just never thought we'd be able to get someone like Dick Giordano, you know. And so Dick said that. We're like, yeah, here's the story. We wrote a story, I think, in like 4 days and got it to Dick. And, you know, at the time, Dick was sick. I hate that it rhymes. But,
understood.
You know, he was...
Yeah.
He wasn't doing well, but boy, oh boy, he put his heart into that story, and it was fantastic.
Yes.
And it came out before he passed away, and he did a signing for it, and boy, what a nice, you know, we felt like we were so lucky to get him, and at the same time, we were able to give him something that he wanted, and, you know, as being fellow creators, we felt like, you know, that nothing is better than that, you know, and what a great guy. I mean... You know, just a real sweetheart of a man. And so we were really happy to kind of be able to accommodate him. And, you know, as unfortunate as everything is, it's really nice to look at that, look back at that and say, yeah, man, look at him. Up until the day he died, he was still kicking ass with his art.
Hear, hear. Absolutely.
You know, there was no flaw in that story. That story was brilliantly executed.
No, I'm with you, man. And, I got to ask, because after 56 issues and so many stories, you guys seem to never run dry. And, I mean, this is really, you know, on pace with a lot of television westerns in terms of the output that you guys are able to do month after month. And because you do so many done-in-one stories, in the case of issue 56, you've got two short stories. But,
yeah.
You know, I'm just impressed with that. Now, every now and then you'll do the six-issue arc. We got his origin story, how he got the scar, and, of course, Six Gun Mojo. But, you know, or pardon me,
War?
Six Gun War. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm thinking of Two Gun Mojo. Six Gun War. Thank you.
Yeah, Seven Gun Hoo-ha. You know? Well, you know, we like the done-in-ones. And actually, for the 56th issue, it was actually Dan DiDio and the crew at DC's idea to kind of, you know, let's have a little fun with the issue. So... We got a Darwin cover, you know, and we said, well, let's do two short stories. And Justin and I both each had a story that we had in mind, you know. And so we did those two stories, and we got two different, completely different artists. And then DC was like, well, you want to interview Jimmy Haywood, the director of Hex? And I'm like, yeah, that'd be fun. You know, because we met Jimmy on the set. We went on a set for a day, and we met him. And, real sweet guy and smart dude and, you know, I think that interview of all interviews gives you an idea of what the movie wanted to be.
Yes.
And is. And so we thought, what a cool thing. And then they put it in the bag with a little poster, and I said, yeah, that's great. You know,
it reminded me of the old 70s Marvel days when they were still owned by Cadence. And
yeah.
I remember that Doc Savage black and white magazine special that had a comic story in it, behind the scenes movie interviews and stills from the movie and stuff. It really felt like that kind of package.
Yeah, that's Dan DiDio. You know, Dan has that 70s kind of thing in his head. And it's cool, though, because it also shows the community. You know, like I said, I missed the letters column because nothing would make me happier than to actually answer letters in the back of Jonah Hex.
Sure.
Because I think it would be a blast, you know. One day they'll come back with it. I just don't think message boards are it, you know. I think message boards, you get a lot of angry people.
Right, there's no filter.
No, there's no filter. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times, you know, I get terrorized on them and I just giggle because I'm like, all right, that's got to be some guy I screwed out of an inking job in the 80s, you know. But, but yeah, so and again, you know, we're 56 issues in. We do not have any lack of ideas. It's really funny because it's the complete opposite. We have a ton.
Wonderful.
And we have, I think, like I said, Jordy. We got three Jordy stories in the drawer right now. We got JH is working on another story.
Oh, terrific!
Brian Stelfreeze has one. He's almost done. Brian, please finish that freaking story.
Excellent.
And we have like a whole bunch of guest artists, some new ones, some old ones. We got Giancarlo Caruso, who did Random Acts of Violence, did an issue.
Yes.
And, you know, we got our guys working. And so there's a lot in the drawer. Like, unlike a lot of books, you know, we kind of make sure they're all being worked on at once. So we're 56 issues in, and we've never missed shipping since we started.
Well, it continues to entertain, man. I remember having you on, I think, inside the first 12 issues, and just really have enjoyed the book month in and month out. And I think the good news is if people come out of the movie positively and seek out the books, they're going to find a stack of very gritty Western stories that are terrific. And again, the essence of Jonah Hex is in that movie. He's he's surrounded by pyrotechnics, but it's still Jonah Hex in that movie.
We went to a screening Thursday night, and, you know, it was a decent amount of people because it was midnight, right?
Okay.
And we had a bunch of guys in their maybe teens and 20s behind us laughing and, you know, at the screen and, you know, because in the right parts. And,
sure.
And we left the theater, and everybody was like, yeah, that was pretty good. You know, we're listening to people, you know? And I'm like saying, well, you know, this theater, nobody booed, nobody, you know, and I'm like, the reviews are acting like they just, you know, killed someone's mother or something. And, you know, the reviews are brutal, right?
Yeah, except for Roger Ebert, ironically.
Yeah, Roger Ebert changed his review in a matter of one day. Did you see that?
No, I only saw the three-star review.
Yeah, he had a three-star review, and then later in the day he had a two-star. And I just think a lot of medication, you know.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but you know what? Again, you know, reviews are about expectations, aren't they?
Indeed, absolutely.
And so we sat in a theater full of people, and my neighbors came, and everyone walked out, and they said, yeah, it was a little dizzying, but it was fun. You know, my buddy Dean is like, dude, it's a summer movie, man. I was entertained, you know? And
yes.
I'm just like, yeah, at the end of the day, you know, I'm not making excuses. I mean, I didn't make the movie, but it's entertainment.
I hear you. I'm with you.
Well, yeah, I don't wish bad on anybody. I got to tell you, I really don't. I'm not that guy. So, you know, I hope everybody succeeds. I hope everybody's a millionaire. you know what I mean? Because I'd love if everybody I knew was millionaires. That'd be great. Even if I wasn't, I'd love that everyone around me was a millionaire. I can use their pool, their car, you know.
Well, I hope that No Way Back stays on the bestsellers list because what a great story, man. First of all, it's wonderful seeing Tony draw, you know, this kind of Hex again. I last year at WonderCon purchased a pencil sketch of Hex, and it's, you know, became instantly one of my favorite pieces that I own.
Oh yeah, Tony's amazing.
But what a great story, man! And again, you're giving us another facet of Hex's backstory that was never really addressed in any of the previous runs.
No, it was actually an idea that Tony and John Albano had. And we kind of took it and ran with it. But I'll tell you one thing I read yesterday. There was an interview with Tony in a California newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
While he was working on our book, I didn't know he got sick and went into a coma for 2 months.
Oh, my God, I didn't either.
Yeah, I was, like, reading that, and I'm like, no wonder why those pages didn't come in for, like, a month. I was like, oh, my God. I'm like, what? I mean, Tony drew 128 pages, pencils and mostly inks, and we were blown away. For a guy his age, he just knocked it out of the park. And again, it was loosely based on an idea. Tony told me and Justin at a con that him and John Albano had an idea that Hex had a brother, you know, half-brother that he didn't know, and we just went crazy with the idea. And we knew in one level the original graphic novel would be something people might be picking up for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, we knew that the diehards were going to buy it. So we had to make those two audiences easy to kind of grasp for those
Certainly.
Two audiences, you know. So that was our pacing. With it, the pacing may seem a little drawn out in places, but we were trying to establish his world, his back life, who he was, and then by the end, what his mother and what his brother mean to him. With a lot of blood and bullets in between. But, you know, we were trying to tell this very big story.
Yeah, this is a real novel. I mean, that's the thing. It's still a graphic novel, but this did read like a real novel, and I appreciated it because I think it was the right pace. I mean, again, it's a very satisfying read, especially for the price. My God, a hardcover for $19.99. I mean, I really think this in this age of increased prices on the monthly magazines. You know, I think consumers more than ever are concerned, is it worth my you know, chunk of change?
Yeah, it's almost 6 issues worth of story, you know, and if a comic's, what, $3.99 now?
Yeah.
So it's 4 times 6, so I mean 24. So yeah, it's like $5 cheaper than it should cost, right? I mean, look, they did a beautiful job designing it. It's a hardcover, so you're not going to, you know, chuck it in a recycle bin.
No, man.
And Tony did a brilliant job drawing it, and it just goes to show, you know, I always said if they ever cancel Hex, I hope they let us do like a book or two like this a year.
I hear you.
You know?
Yes, absolutely,
I hope Dan DiDio is listening. Dan, don't cancel it. But if you do, you know, this would be fun.
Well, I hope that you guys are given the hardcover slipcase treatment for the body of work that you guys have done. Because I'd like to see an absolute Hex or a couple volumes of them.
We would love a Jordy Burnett collection.
Sure.
You know, like the 14 or 16 stories Jordy did into one book. That's like a fantasy of mine, because I've been a fan of Jordy's way before. Obviously, I've been a fan of his since Torpedo, so much so that I'm translating the books.
I've been picking those up and wanted to ask you about those. Go right ahead.
Yeah, no, they were books that put out by a smaller company in the 80s, I guess, or 90, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved them, but they only translated a bunch of them, and IDW knew I... Scott Dunbar knew I was a huge fan and knew I knew Jordy, and we kind of got the whole deal together where they would print every single Torpedo book in a hardcover form, and then he asked me if I wanted to translate it. And I jumped at it. I get paid like food stamps to do it, but I'm doing it out of love. And they're just wonderful books about the most miserable hitman on earth. They're horrible. You know, he's just a horrible man. The stories are brilliant. And that was my first, you know, first time I saw Jordy. And people would tell me, oh, he's like the Spanish Joe Kubert. You know, that's how I was described. But as I got into his art, you know, there's a certain brilliant shortcut and ease about his work that I think resonates in other artists, you know.
Well, and I love and I understand why he does it, because I'm sure there's such a great aftermarket for his work. But, you know, every now and then you come across this beautiful splash page, and it's really like looking at a portrait. And it feels more like real art when I see Jordy's pages sometimes, and especially a splash page like that. Because, again, it just feels like a finished piece and really a singular piece, even though it's part of this bigger story. And you can't help but, like, spend a moment with it in a way that I don't spend with a lot of other splash pages.
No, and you know what, Jordy's funny, because he puts the word balloons on the original art. So he figures out how big they're going to be and puts them in there, which I love because he doesn't speak English, you know. And he's a wonderful man. We met in Barcelona, and we had his son translated between both of us, because he really embarrassing. And this is the typical American, right? I only speak English.
Understood.
Okay. So Jordy goes to me in broken English, do you speak Spanish? I'm like, no. He goes, how about French? I'm like, no. How about Portuguese? No. How about Italian? I'm like, no. And he goes, I said, do you speak English? He goes, no. I'm like, shit. You know, and it's just like he knew four or five languages, but he didn't know English.
So, well, he's a citizen of the world, and we're stuck here in America, man.
But what a brilliant guy.
That's really cool. Now, when you translate the torpedo stories through his son, do you talk? Do you do any type of pep talk and say?
Actually, what happens is they get word for word translations.
Okay.
So they're not actually 100% making sense.
Right.
But they're translated word for word, and then what I do is I kind of put them together and make them make sense.
Okay.
So I'm not actually translating it the words. But I'm translating what it is he's saying, and then try to use the slang of the day because it's right around Prohibition and after Prohibition, so it takes place in the late 20s, early 30s, and you know, so I kind of follow. I did this book nobody read called Doc Walloper, and it took place in the 20s, and I worked on it with Ed Burns, and we did a ton of research on the language. So when I got the torpedo stuff, I was like, oh, I know how to do this.
Oh, that's interesting. Where did that book come out? The Doc
Walloper. It came out from Virgin Comics. I think it sold 7 copies.
Oh man! Well,
but I got to work with Ed Burns on it, and I respect and like the dude. And you know, we had fun working on it together. And it was a trade book. I'm guessing somewhere out there. It was just about a dock worker during Prohibition.
Oh, excuse me. I saw that book. I was thinking Doc like a doctor. I wasn't thinking Doc Walloper or anything. You know.
Ooh, that's a good name. Ooh, Doc Walloper. Yeah, he's like a dentist. He just punches you and then pulls your teeth out.
So he's like a strike breaker or whatever, right?
There you go. Yeah, he was a strike. He was like a dock worker that got involved with the right people and then the wrong people, and then pretty much he fell in love with a girl. It was very. It was something Ed always had in his mind, and he wanted to see it graphically done. You know, we had a blast on it. It was very wordy, but. Honestly, I liked it. The art was interesting, and it was one of those projects that, you know, I'm halfway through working on it, and I'm sitting in a room with Ed Burns. I'm like, what am I doing here? You're like, how did I get here?
Fantastic.
Know? Yeah, so it was a fun book, but like I said, it probably sold like 30 or 40 copies.
Well,
you know?
I'm going to have to search around, and I forget who bought all of Virgin's properties.
Did somebody buy them?
Yeah, somebody did, and I can't remember who right now.
Who was that guy?
Yeah, I can't. It might have been Radical, actually. Your buddies on Time Bomb.
No, I don't think they would have told me.
Okay, because and let's talk about Time Bomb for a second, because man, I am so thrilled to see you back with Paul Galassi. I would love to see Paul do a Hex story at some point.
Paul's done 2 Hex stories so far.
I'm gonna have to go back and find him. I didn't remember that.
And Paul's he did the Hyde Hotel Massacre, and then he did one early on, and I'm guessing it's between issue 8 and 12 or something.
Okay.
I'm forgetting, because it's years ago.
Okay.
But Paul did 2 of the most amazing issues of Hex. The last one he did, the Hyde Hotel Massacre, I want to say it was like 42 or something like that, and it was just fantastic. It was Paul inking himself, and it just looked like the classic Paul that I fell in love with when I was a kid. And then when we got Time Bomb, Radical, the guys at Radical, who just wonderful people, approached us about, and we hit them with this idea, and Barry that runs Radical just said, you know, who do you want to draw it, and how many pages do you need to tell the story? And
fantastic.
We just like, yeah, we said, well, we need 150 pages. And he says, and who do you want to draw it? And I said, well, Dream Guy? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, Paul Galassi. So they got him.
Fantastic.
And Paul pencils and inks his own stuff, and it's just beautiful. And it's made for Paul. That's why, like, it's all Nazis and spies and sexy women and you know, Mexican standoffs and missiles and bombs and torture chambers, and it's every genre slammed together: time travel and war, and you know. It was one of those stories I had since I was a kid, and then when Justin and I really sat down to work out the how this story would work, we kind of came up with this whole premise of the Nazis having an underground city in Berlin that nobody ever knew about. And you know, it's modern day. It's actually a couple of years from now, and they discover the city and accidentally trigger an Omega bomb that releases a virus that is going to wipe out all human life on Earth. And that's the setup. And, you know, there's a team that has to go back in time to take it out. And it was supposed to be, they were supposed to go back in time only like a week.
Okay.
And stop the missile from being launched and all that stuff. And something goes wrong, and they actually go back to, like, the last couple of weeks of World War II.
Fantastic.
And they have to go into Berlin and take out the missile.
Outstanding.
And yeah, it's actually, from my childhood, it's actually loosely, bizarrely based on Where Eagles Dare.
I saw you say that in an interview online.
Yeah.
And that's a great Richard Burton movie from, like, 69.
Richard Burton, young Clint Eastwood as a killer in it, and... And the girls from the Hammer films are in it, too. It's just a fun movie, but it was sort of like that adventure film, you know, that real spy war movie, which I happen to love that genre. And honestly, Paul is the guy to do that stuff.
I completely agree. And I know he was so inspired as a kid, because he was really young doing all the Shang-Chi stuff that he did.
16 years old, man.
Insane. Absolutely insane.
His first Marvel work was when he was 16.
In
high school.
You know, and I think you put me together with Paul way back when I did my Word Balloon interview with him. And I can't thank you enough, because it was a pleasure talking to him. And yeah, like you and I, he is a guy that grew up with those same kind of influences and loves drawing that stuff. Still.
Oh, remember, you know, I mean, when I was a kid, I fell in love with Shang-Chi, not because of the Bruce Lee thing, but because it felt like Bruce Lee got dumped in the middle of a James Bond movie.
No question. Clive Reston was James Bond's son in more ways than one. Absolutely.
And those comics, I just felt like, oh, my God, these are the coolest comics on Earth. And they've never reprinted them because there's a problem with the rights for Fu Manchu.
That's what I figured. The Sax Rohmer estate, the guy who wrote the original Fu Manchu stuff, it's a shame because they're incredible.
Yeah, I told him, I said, just go back and call him, you know, Fu Man Fu.
Let's talk about Random Acts of Violence, because,
okay.
Man.
Since we're there.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, and you mentioned Giancarlo Caracuzzo doing the art on Hex.
Yeah.
It's great because, again, I think based on our previous conversations, I know you're a slasher movie fan. And I think you have that right perspective when it comes to some of the torture horror that we're dealing with right now, that you get it, but I don't know. It seems like sometimes you like it, but it better be good, because I think it's very easy to make shitty torture horror these days.
Well, I you know, it's funny, because I saw the remake of, I was going to say Freddy.
Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th, and I saw the remake also of the guy with the things on his fingers. Come on, help me out here.
That's not Freddy Krueger?
Freddy Krueger, yeah.
Nightmare
on Elm Street.
That's right, Nightmare on Elm Street. That's right.
Right, and it's amazing to me how this great source material, like Friday the 13th, right?
Yes.
The remake did nothing to build on the story.
Right.
It just kind of said, yeah, we're just going to give you the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because... because, you know, there was some point a couple of years ago when they asked Justin and I to do a Friday the 13th series. And you know, Jason and Justin and I were like, should we do this? And I said, you know, I think I want to do this because I have an idea. I can explain the lake. I can explain why the guy comes, why the kid is alive and he's in the lake, you know. And in that story, we told why Jason exists and why he can't die. And I just said, well, look, they're going to make the movie. I hope they address the idea that, because it makes it scarier if you can actually give a reason.
Sure.
I think. I think there are certain movies, and help me out with the name, where it was the two people in the bedroom and it just, the videotape, it was out last year or this past year.
Paranormal Activity?
Paranormal Activity. So I saw that and I was like, you know, I get why people were scared. But none of it made sense to me. Like, none of it, I said, all right, if it's me, number one, I have I'd have a TV in my room, in my bedroom, on. Because I figured a demon may not come. Number two, I wouldn't sleep in that room. Number three, I'd get the hell out of that house. Okay? Once my Ouija board went on fire in my living room, I'd move. Okay? And, you know, they tried to black it up and say, oh, well, the demon will follow you anywhere you go. Really? Really? I'm going to sleep in an airport? And the demon's going to come through the airport, you know? I just felt like I didn't buy the movie, and although it was creepy in spots, I felt like this is playing to a certain audience, and I get it, right? And then they remake Friday 13th and this and that, and you know, and I'm watching it, and they're not adding anything.
I understand. You know? Yeah.
Even Halloween by Rob Zombie, and I love Rob Zombie, but I like Rob Zombie horror movies. I don't like Rob Zombie remaking horror movies.
I understand.
And then I'm very picky about my horror, because there's some horror I think it should be disturbing, and I should be upset, and you know, I should be shaken a little bit.
And you're
desensitized. I think I should be scared. You know.
Yeah.
And I don't think I should be thrilled. I'd be thrilled by the blood and guts. I should be mortified and horrified.
Certainly.
And I think that's how our movie works. And unfortunately, you kind of get this weird thing when you see these movies that it looks like they're kind of like want you to cheer on the killer.
Yes.
And the only time I wanted to cheer on anybody killing anybody was at the end of Hostel when that guy got out, you know? Did you see that movie?
No, I didn't, because, again, I heard torture porn, and that's why I stayed away from it. I think I remember you talking about Hostel. Go ahead.
That movie, the last 20 minutes are wonderful.
Okay.
It turns into a Tarantino movie. And there's this, you know, like Tarantino understands horror movies. He understands horror. You look at Pulp Fiction when Bruce Willis is in that pawn shop and he's looking for weapons. And we don't have to even see anything, but we see him looking and he pulls down that sword and we got a lot of visions of what's going to happen next.
Yes.
You know, and he understands the horror. And, he, you know, in all these, in Kill Bill, and he understands when it gets ludicrous and he understands when it's horrifying. And very few directors do. So when we did Random Acts of Violence, we wanted it to be, in a way, it's sort of, you know, a statement. In a way, we wanted to make sure you liked these guys, but they weren't so likable that you felt comfortable with them. Because they do some pretty screwed up things here and there. But you like them, but you realize that they're caught in something bigger than them.
Yes.
You know, and we wanted to pace the book. Well, you know, we did the thing where it's like three issues, right? It was 66 pages.
Okay.
But we only made it $7. You know, we wanted to make sure people got a whole story. But to say it was a complete horror story, I think Random Acts of Violence was a little bit of a mix of an action movie slash horror movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like that first Saw movie where there's a puzzle and it's a suspense movie more than it is flat out horror. And
yeah,
you're wondering what's the connection and why, you know, there's just a more of a story to it rather than just waiting for the next slash.
Yeah, and you know, we spent a lot of time with the guys doing the convention scene.
Absolutely.
You know, talking to each other, and that's the kind of stuff that I always remember. Even from the best horror films, I kind of remember the non. I'm sorry, I'm giving them Amanda. Amanda's here, and she's going to pick up a friend at the airport.
Hi, Amanda.
Say hello, Amanda.
Hello.
Yay.
There you go. So yes, I remember the quiet moments on these kind of movies, and I always feel like I got to get to know these characters. Before I, you know, I have to care for everybody, so before I get involved in the story. So we spent a lot of time, again, not a conventional comic. Looking back, it didn't get ordered very well, but we're very happy that at least Amazon sells it and retailers can keep getting it, and we're hoping one day to make our money back on it.
I hope you do, man, because I would tell fans truly to seek it out, because it is a great combination. Look inside the comic book business, and also a fun slasher story. Dude, I'm a hard sell on horror. It really has to be good for me to really enjoy it. Again, knowing where you're coming from in your opinions on horror films, I thought you did a great job of telling a very entertaining, funny story at times. And any comic fan that is used to seeing conventions and going to stores for signings and stuff is going to really enjoy the backdrop that you've put this story on.
Well, thanks, man. Thanks.
Truly.
I appreciate it. I mean, we have two more books like that coming out, and I can't say what they are yet, but we have two more graphic novels, 66-page, and one of them's another one's a horror one, but it's a horror slash, I guess in the vein of The Thing, let's just say, in a weird way. And then we have a modern-day Western.
Oh, that's great. I always loved when you did the Black Bull story with Phil Noto, and I'm blanking.
Yeah, New West.
New West, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I loved doing that book. And, you know, that was just, you know, that was just me doing Chinatown, modern-day Chinatown, you know. But you know, we're doing a lot of these books, and like Random Acts and the two other books we got coming up, I'm pretty much taking the money I'm making on the comics and putting it back into other books. You know, I'm paying my rent and the mortgage and all that kind of stuff, and whatever we got left over, I have, like, guys working on a couple of books that Justin and I are doing, and we hope they break even. Like, Back to Brooklyn did, you know, Random Acts didn't, you know, we hope there's a leveling off by the time the next year goes by. You know, it's all risks, and we're taking the risks ourselves, because we love comics, and I still think it's the best storytelling method there is out there. It's my favorite, and you know, I'm one of those guys. I don't buy Reflex comics. I don't buy X-Men because I have all the other ones. I kind of pick and choose what I like, and
sure,
my taste change constantly. So we have a lot of these type of books, and you know, I work really hard. Like I said, I go on Twitter. You see me on there, kind of working the audience and talking to people, and I talk to everybody. So we're going to experiment, and it's fun working on this stuff, you know, for Marvel and DC and Radical and all that. But in the end, we have books that don't really fit anybody's menu. And that's what Random Acts of Violence, let's be honest, nobody wanted it. You know, it just didn't fit anything. And, you know, we even Last Resort, we were happy that IDW kind of went for it.
Yes.
But honestly, you know, they were selling it like a zombie story, but it wasn't really a zombie story. You know, it was about a biological disaster.
Right.
You know, if I was smarter, I would have put some oil spill in it and got extra press, maybe sold it. But
unfortunately,
see, we have our own horror happening every day because I'm down in Florida. I'm right on the Gulf.
Wow.
So so we're in the place where
you're vulnerable.
Well, we're looking. You know,
sure.
We look
sure.
out to the water. Amanda and I go down to the beach as much as we can every week, and we go into the water. And while it's still good, we don't know how long it's going to last. You know, we're watching the government talk about everything except stopping the oil.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed that. It's switch gears to who's paying for what and cleanup and everything. And, you know, what they're not showing, and which what I see here, is the massive amount of panic to everybody. Everybody down here is worried about houses and fumes and what's going to happen to the beaches and how many dead animals there are. And, you know, people forget how much sea life is in the Gulf and what a beautiful place it is, and how, you know, if this gets destroyed, how it affects everyone. And it's a shame. I mean, I think Larry King's doing a thing tonight, you know, to raise money.
Yeah, as we're taping, the telethon is tonight, yeah.
Right. And my, you know, my plan, if I could tell the president anything, if I could just say, you know, two things you need to do. All your energy on Earth, you found it. All the energy on Earth into stopping it. All of it. Forget about two relief wells. How about 19? How about start now?
Yeah.
19 relief wells.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, for a month, add 5 cents a gallon to the gas. Forget about BP and what they're paying out. Add 5 cents to the gas. And in a matter of a month, I think we'd raise like $10 billion, okay, if you added 5 cents a gallon, and take that 5 cents per gallon and put it into cleanup and put it into animal preservation and put it into help getting people from outside to come and clean up. Now, we're talking billions of dollars if you add a nickel, okay?
Right.
It's so simple. Would anyone in their right mind, and I say this because the first thing people go, BP should be paying for it. But you know what? BP can only do so much.
Right.
A nickel per gallon for a month, put all the money towards cleanup, you'd be shocked.
No, I agree. And if anything, start some jobs programs and put people to work.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, you know, we're near the Clearwater area, so it's not hitting here yet.
Understood.
But they have the classes where they're training people to clean up the animals, and you know, they're doing all the classes stuff, preparing for it. But honestly, you know, we don't even know what's going on there, and it's just so many things dying, so many animals. I feel bad for animals. I'm sorry. I'm like that guy. I will eat a cow down to nothing.
Understood.
But at the same time, you know, I see a dead dolphin and I'm mortified.
Oh my God, yeah. No, it is. It's sick. It really is sick, man.
Yeah, and there's so much sea life under the water that we're just not hearing about it. They don't want to put it on the news because it's horrific.
Well, you know, I heard Charles Osgood at the start of the spill talk about the area of Alaska that was affected by the Exxon Valdez, and that was 12 years ago. It's still dead.
Yeah.
It still hasn't come back. And that's the reality, as you say, they don't want to talk about.
No, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to put the images on it. And BP has been doing their best job ever keeping people away from the heavily destroyed areas.
Yes.
They really are. They still are. And
they're antagonistic.
The Coast Guard's working with them.
Say that again?
The Coast Guard is working with them as well. They're keeping people away. This, you know, it's so funny because one of the guys from the New Orleans government said, yeah, his guys went on a boat with shot vacs, you know, the wet vacs.
Sure,
And it was sucking up oil. And they're like, why can't we just get 10,000 of these working tomorrow? And, you know, it's just amazing to me. Like BP says in a 60-mile radius, they have 14 big ships cleaning up. And I'm like, really? I'm like, 14 ships? I'm like, shouldn't that be like 8,000 ships?
Exactly.
There, I don't get it. I don't understand what has to happen for this president to lose his shit.
I know.
And start saying, you know what? I know we got a lot of wars going on out there, but we need to bring half our boys back.
Yeah, this is a crisis. You're absolutely right.
This is a crisis that will, guess what? You know, I'll be dead by the time everything settles in. But if you have kids, man, oh, my God, what a shame.
I agree.
Yeah, people, you see the beaches are packed right now when down in Clearwater, because people are saying, yeah, I got to bring my kids here so they can see it before.
Before it all dies.
Yeah, before it all dies.
Unbelievable, man.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So that's a horror. That's a whole thing horror in itself, you know.
Yeah, no kidding.
Honestly, when we pitched Freedom Fighters, I so wanted to make the whole series about political stuff like that. But, you know, then again, it'd never get published. So.
Jeez. You're behind the new Freedom Fighters?
Yeah, they just announced it. Justin and I are doing an ongoing series.
And when does that start?
I think September.
Okay.
And it's ongoing, and we're handling it like big superhero action comic with the classic characters.
I was going to ask, are these new versions of the classic characters, or?
We wrote.
Battle for Bloodhaven and the Freedom Fighter miniseries.
Right,
sure.
We wrote two. Freedom Fighters miniseries.
Yes.
In the past, and it's sort of like our next stop with the characters. You
okay.
Know? You know, and rather than a limited series, DC greenlit an ongoing. You know, which we're very happy about. I think they greenlit it right after because we left Power Girl.
Yes.
And they wanted to get something else for us, and Dan always liked what we did. You know, Dan the deal liked what we did on Freedom Fighters, so it seemed like a natural thing, and people like the character. It's never a big-selling book, you know, but it has its audience.
Well, that's cool.
We have Travis Moore.
Oh, wonderful.
Is drawing it, and Dave Johnson is doing the covers.
Oh, fantastic. That's great, man.
Yeah, we love Dave.
You know, we talked again in April about the wrap-up to Power Girl. It was a fantastic run, and hats off to the three of you, and I'm sorry that the three of you couldn't stay together. But again, you've got 12 issues of a great Power Girl series, and no matter what direction the series goes beyond that and stuff, I mean, I think that's a great run that's helped redefine the character and helped her, you know, reestablish herself in the DC universe.
Yeah, our main job with Power Girl was to give her a personality. Because too often when people write her in a book, she's this angry, punching, big-breasted animal running towards you. And, you know, I just like the fact that, you know, we're going to get a character where people consider her a B character. Now, we never did. We always considered her... we always considered her like an A character, and we wrote her like an A character, and we said, you know, we have Amanda on it, so let's have some fun. You know, let's make the book fun, where all the other books are just been really heavy and fight books, you know.
Yeah,
and
we
wanted to do something different. I mean, we gave all the moments, you know, with her punching her way out of things
sure.
and all that stuff, But in the end, we wanted to make the... We had Amanda on it. When you have Amanda on the book, you kind of got to do something a little different. Because she has a sensibility and a sense of humor that so many artists don't have. And so I think, you know, and she never did 12 issues in a row of anything. So
really? Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, she's never... I mean, this is the first thing... It nearly killed her because she wasn't used to a monthly schedule, and she got them all done. And you know, one day it's going to make a nice, really big trade, and we're very proud of it. And I think Judd is going to do just great. I saw a preview of the new book, and it looks great.
So, terrific.
You know, we handed him the torch. He runs with it, and hopefully, people keep buying it. You know.
Absolutely, man. No, I think that's terrific. And again, I something I mentioned to you before, was so thrilled that you guys brought back Vartox. One of my favorite
super sexy man. You know, it's funny. I have a mustache just like his now, and Amanda kind of asked me to do that, and I'm just like, "What is she trying to say?" Because I definitely have the hairy legs like he does, so. and the hairy chest.
Just so don't wear the vest, you know.
He's all man, you know.
Yes, he is.
And we you know, our fun was putting him in the last issue as well. We kind of put everybody in the last issue.
Yeah, that was a great. Exactly, it was a wonderful kind of. Like final episode of a series kind of thing where everybody kind of makes their, you know, has their 5 minutes on screen, on stage before,
well,
before they say goodbye.
I know if Dan Dio called me and said, we want you to do a Vortox series, Amanda would do it. I just don't think anybody would buy it, honestly, but I think Amanda would do it in a heartbeat.
Well, I think, yeah, guys my age that were reading the 20-cent comics back then and remember Vartox all too well, I think appreciated him coming back the way you guys brought him back.
Well, you know, he was really serious, but, you know, he was a sad character. I mean, as much as he was a goon to Power Girl, he was also really sweet. You know, it was kind of like that guy that just keeps trying so hard. And we looked at it like, you know, Power Girl would be attracted to him just for the idea that he kind of is just after her so badly. You know, she got charmed by him. And then we said, well, let's do Power Girl getting a little drunk on space wine. You know? And we took a lot of crap from people for those issues.
Really?
Because they said it was too corny and too silly. And I'm just like, you know what? Comics can be silly sometimes. It doesn't mean it's the end of the character. And I can't stand a comic that's just so serious every moment.
I agree.
There's got to be some kind of steam let out, you know?
I think you guys were misunderstood during Wednesday Comics because you were surrounded by so many homages to great adventure strips that they didn't know what to make of your Supergirl at first.
No, and then I had to do the Aquaman thing because I always had it in my head that it was Dennis, that Aquaman is Dennis Leary as Aquaman. when we put Aquaman in there, I have him, you know, I just always thought of Aquaman as, this is a guy, you know, water covers so much of the planet, and how could Aquaman really do anything if everything can speak to him? Every sea life can, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And so we had him have a phone, a shell phone, and had the fish bugging him and calling him, and, you know, it was completely insane, but Amanda pulled it off, and it was, like, insanely cute.
I agree.
But we also, you know, we also kind of gave up with the Wednesday comics because we were like, look who's in this book. What the hell are we going to do? And Amanda's like, let's just go for pure, cute, vomiting, cute type of fun. You know, let's Supergirl with the pets.
But that was like, fun.
Yeah, you know, so yeah, I think you just need a variety. I love the book. I mean, but I honestly did not expect that people would actually enjoy our strip so much. I really thought that we were just like, we're kind of surrounded by the giants in the industry, and hopefully we don't get too much abuse for the stuff we're doing, you know? Because Amanda and I were both kind of like, oh my God, look at this Commandy. Oh, my God, look at the, you know, we kept going, oh no, Dave Gibbons writing that? Oh, what am I going to, you know, why do they want us?
Yeah, you but it's like Peanuts sitting next to Steve Canyon. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, absolutely not. And for the format, you know, I've never done anything like that, so I was like, okay, everyone should stand alone, yet it should continue.
Yes.
You know? But it's fun. I mean, it's a challenge. I got to say, you know, Mark Chiarello and Dan DiDio thought we could do it, and so we did it. And Amanda did it while she was doing Power Girl, so that was part of her stress as well.
Wow.
It was a lot of work. And the pages are huge. They're like the size of a chair.
Very cool, man.
Yeah.
Jesus. You know, and I'm sorry, man. I said 45 minutes. I'm keeping you too long. Do you have to go? I don't want to mess you up.
No, it's all good. My cat's just looking at me. I don't know. Like, if you have animals?
No, I used to. Not in my current place, no. But I've had
a black cat that just sits there and stares at me. Like it's trying to eat my soul. I don't know what it wants. It's just like, look, and it licks its chops once in a while.
I just had two other questions. And
shoot.
With these little passion projects like Random Acts of Violence, the other novellas that are coming up, you know, with the digital market and stuff, I understand you say that these are things that you're doing because you really want to. Do you see the digital market as a place to, you know, maybe recoup some of these costs on some of these things?
Well, we put the pro on Comixology.
Uh-huh.
2 weeks ago, and for $3.99, which is, I think, okay. And and we sold over 500 copies.
Fantastic.
In a week.
That's
now,
wonderful.
We also made sure retailers had the books. So we wanted to make sure everybody's happy, because
sure.
It's a fine line. I don't want to report. The retailers are my guys.
I understand.
So I make sure they have, I overprint, I do everything I can to make sure they can keep making money off our stuff. This week, we're putting The Resistance, a book, 8-issue book Justin and I did for Wildstorm. We got all the rights back.
Okay.
And we're putting it on Comixology, and I think we're going to make the first issue free.
Okay.
And then like $1.99 after that, you know? And I think there's a, I think it's a good, it's a revenue, it can make some revenue. I think it helps. We're trying to do a deal with Random Acts and Back to Brooklyn. It all helps. You don't make a ton of money because, you know,
everybody gets their cut.
Everybody gets a cut. By the time we get our cut, it's not a lot, you know, but you know what? Every bit counts. It's sort of like, it's so funny because, I'll go on Twitter and, you know, I'll recommend Random Acts and somebody will say, well, you know, my retailer doesn't have one. I'm like, well, who's the store? You know, like I'll track down the store and make sure the guy orders it for them. You
okay,
know?
Okay.
And it's just because when it's grassroots, every sale means something.
Certainly.
So I go out there and I wave that flag and I push it like nothing, you know, like nobody else. Business.
Sure.
I'm sure people are sick of me on that thing, but, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I got 5,000 people following me. God, if I had one out of every 10 people bought the book, I'd be very happy.
Understood.
You know?
Absolutely.
So I think digital's great because I think people have iPads. I like the idea that somebody in, you know, New Zealand can download it.
Certainly.
You know, where they couldn't normally maybe couldn't get the comic right away. Or,
right.
You know, or somebody that's learning English in Japan wants to download the book. I kind of dig that. I like that. I don't see it putting bookstores out of business, but I do have a recommendation for comic book stores, and that's to really play up the social aspect of your store.
Agreed.
A little bit more. There's a store in San Francisco called Isotope.
Yep.
And if you want to get a good example of how to do it, that guy, James Syme there, is just brilliant.
I completely agree. There's great stores in Chicago like that as well, Challengers.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
Chicago Comics.
Well.
Yep.
Yep. And I think when you get people in on a Wednesday, I think it should be a social event. I think it should be fun. I think there should be couches. I think there should be soda and pizza and whatever the hell else you can shove in there. And I think you should keep people there and let them socialize and make it a gathering place.
Yes.
I think it should be Starbucks, but comics.
I completely agree. And, you know, if I were ever to risk the life savings and go into the comic book business, that's exactly what I would do, is a coffee and juice bar / comic book store. I agree with you.
I think if you have a big enough room, put some washing machines in the back. If you're in a metropolis, you know. I think also in the back room, a couple of girls dressed up in superhero outfits giving massages.
Doesn't hurt. Wow, man.
I'm just saying. Why not? Amanda's dream always has been to open a strip joint where all the girls are dressed like superheroes and spacemen and cowboys and, you know, like really costumed strippers.
You have the coolest girlfriend, man. I swear to God. Or
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, whatever your relationship is.
Amanda gets it because she's not... I don't give her any reason to be threatened by any other woman. She's the girl for me. There is no other girl for me. She knows it. I don't care how pretty, how beautiful, how whatever. They're not her. So although they may be great to look at and great to talk to, she's my girl.
Very
and she
sweet.
Knows it, and I make sure she knows it. So there's never the threat.
That's awesome, man.
And that's the secret of any relationship, is never forgetting that you're always dating. You know, the catch-22 of all women is they want to chase you on some level, and then flip it, and they want to be chased on some level. But they're all crazy. I love them, but they're all crazy. You know, we all have this thing. When I met Amanda, she told me, you know, I saw Star Wars 24 times in the theater, and I'm like, okay, we're going out, you know. And she gets it. She's like a guy, you know, she gets it. She did the pro and she's laughing, you know.
Which is one of the reasons why I've always had a lot of respect for Amanda, and I learned that from our first interview.
Yeah, it's so funny because, you know, all the feminine groups and all these kind of groups want to, you know, Amanda kind of draws anything she wants. And you can't really pick on her because there's a certain charm and joy to her really raunchy stuff.
Yes.
And I always say, because she's so secure, that these conventional problems that some people have with the art form are not a problem with her, because she doesn't look at it that way. She never looks at Power Girl as this sex bomb, you know, and so much so that we wrote the book with Tara and Power Girl, you know, two
yes,
girls
yes.
together, and it never comes off lecherous or creepy. Even the 12th issue, we had it where people were like, what are they doing? They're laying there talking about how they feel about each other, and I'm like, yes. I said, and it's going to be up to you how you decipher that, because if you're a little bit of a lech, you're going to think they're going to start making out any minute.
You bet.
Okay? But at the same time, you're saying, God, they're bonding.
Right. They're real friends.
They're real friends, and they're really comfortable with each other. And it was a thing that I don't see enough in a lot of books, is the idea that, you know, these characters are friends.
Well, yeah, it was Thelma and Louise without the suicide at the end, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
They were really bonding. Yeah, I agree.
And let's be honest, that ending was ridiculous.
It was ridiculous. I completely agree. See, this is good.
What a waste of a good car.
All right, Jim, I think I've wasted enough of your time, but I
hope we learned something.
I think we did. I think we all did. I'll see you in San Diego. You guys got any big plans as far as
I'm going to be at the Radical Booth. Me and Paul DeLacy are going to be signing at the Radical Booth.
Fantastic. I will see you boys there.
We're going to have fun.
Excellent.
Okay, man.
Are you doing a panel or anything, or just hanging out?
Yeah, we have a panel for Time Bomb, and then Amanda and I are on a panel for some documentary they made that we're in. Which is mortifying, because the last thing in the world I want to see is me on a screen, so I'll probably come in afterwards, but late.
Well, we will seek you out, and again, looking forward to the new Freedom Fighters story that's coming in September. And Time Bomb from Radical looks great, and it's in that $4.99 graphic novel format that Last Days of Crime, I think, is succeeding in as well. And
always
happy to see you working with Paul Galassi. And you and Justin continue to churn out those great Hex stories, man. Like I said, I think you guys are bulletproof. It doesn't matter what the movie does. You're turning out a wonderful Western, and I hope that it continues from DC, because you clearly have a lot of more stories to come, as you say, and I can't wait to read them.
Well, thanks, dude.
Jimmy Palmiotti, whom along with Justin Gray writes some of the best genre fiction you can find in comics, and in pretty much every genre as well. We talked a lot about his current books. You should check out his backlog as well. And the place to do it is at today's sponsor of Word Balloon, InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. It's your place for hardbacks, trade paperbacks, essentials, absolute editions, all at great savings of 35% or more off the standard retail price. Don't forget, if you get orders of $50 or more, it's free shipping at InStockTrades.com. We talked about some of the great books you can get from Jimmy Palmiotti. How about Back to Brooklyn, the trade paperback that runs at $14.99 at InStockTrades.com. It's just $9.44. Do yourself a favor, check out Random Acts of Violence. The standard retail price is $6.99. They got it for $4.40. Jonah Hex, Guns of Vengeance, that collects issues 7 through 12, and it has art by Luke Ross, Paul Galassi. The standard retail price is $12.99 at InStockTrades.com, just $8.18. There's lots of Jonah Hex trades waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening. Lots of great shows on the way. The Road to San Diego continues. Word Balloon will continue to give you coverage. You heard about Jimmy's plans. Word Balloon will be there at the Catherine and Stuart Immonen Spotlight panel, the podcasting panel, and the Bendis panel when he'll be talking about Scarlet. That's his Saturday panel. More details to come as soon as I get room numbers, and I'll be wandering the aisles, so if you see me, be sure to say hello. Questions or comments about the show, feel free to reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. You can follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon. And, of course, come to our website, wordballoon.com. Come to our message board. Start a thread on this episode or any subjects you'd like to talk about. Check out the discussion that's going on at wordballoon.com. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.